From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Los Angeles Dodgers are now wards of Major League Baseball. Ahead on Only a Game, Bud Selig's stunning takeover of the storied franchise. Also, a conversation with 19-year pitching veteran Tim Wakefield about the mystery of the knuckleball, and a look at the world's highest-paid athletes by sport and by country. Also ahead, the youthful delights of korfball.
I have found that they love it being a co-ed game. They can play with their boyfriend or their girlfriend, and it's something that they really probably haven't done since elementary school, is play a sport together.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig apparently thinks owner Frank McCourt no longer seems capable of running the Los Angeles Dodgers in a sensible and sustainable way, so Mr. Selig announced this week that the league will take over that responsibility. Should we care about that? ESPN and Only a Game baseball guy Tim Kirkjian is among the many who think we should, because this isn't the Montreal Expos we're talking about.
You could make a strong case. This is the greatest franchise in the history of the National League, and maybe after the Yankees, the greatest franchise in baseball history.
Great as the Dodgers franchise has been, and in this case, great means not only championships on both coasts, six of them altogether, and the L.A. glitz factor, but also Jackie Robinson and the decades during which the Dodgers occupied first place in the hearts of Brooklyn residents. According to Tim Kirkjian, the contemporary baseball scene in Los Angeles has been discouraging and worse.
It's just not what it used to be. There are long lines of concession stands. There's graffiti in the bathrooms. There was a near death in the parking lot. And on a Sunday afternoon, 77 degrees at Dodger Stadium, they drew 27,000 people. That is unheard of. And a Dodger, former Dodger, texted me the other day and said, we have the 30-year anniversary of us winning the 1981 World Series, and the Dodgers aren't going to do anything about a reunion.
Some of the financial problems have come about as a result of the divorce between Frank and Jamie McCourt, but according to New York Times sports writer Richard Sandomir, at least one of the most flagrant lapses in sound management of the ball club transpired when the McCourts were still borrowing money together, before it occurred to them that they no longer wished to be married to one another.
Probably the worst thing is the revelation that came out in court documents during the divorce trial that Frank and Jamie McCourt took $108 million out of the Dodgers for their personal use to buy real estate and for personal mortgages, money that could better be used to improve the team.
The borrowing escalated recently when Frank McCourt went to the Fox Network for help, a development which, for various reasons, caught the attention of Commissioner Selig. Dylan Hernandez covers the Dodgers for the Los Angeles Times, and he's been following the team's downward spiral.
What we did know was that Frank McCourt had to borrow $30 million from Fox to make payroll. The money that they borrowed from Fox didn't go directly to the team, because had that been the case, Selig would have been able to shoot that down. He has veto power over any kind of loans between broadcasters and teams. And so instead what happened was that Fox loaned the money directly to Frank McCourt, and from what we heard, Selig was not happy about that.
Dylan Hernandez characterizes the current Dodgers roster as underwhelming, at least for a team in one of baseball's major markets, and he says the turmoil in the front office hasn't gone unnoticed by the players, even though distractions come with the territory in Los Angeles.
You know, it's kind of an annoyance probably for the players, just in that there are probably four or five times as many reporters as usual. Some players had big crowds around them asking them, what do you think about this? But when you really look at it, this is nothing new for this team. There have been a lot of distractions here over the years with Frank McCourt's divorce. Obviously, when Manny Ramirez was suspended a couple years ago for testing positive for performance-enhancing drugs, that was a big day. When Manny showed up, that was a big day. When they got rid of Manny, that was a big day.
As part of their coverage of the McCourt saga, Hernandez's colleagues at the LA Times have been talking to fans at the ballpark. An unscientific survey suggests that they're relieved by Commissioner Selig's decision.
Most of the fans seem pleased. I've been getting a lot of emails over the last 24 hours, and most of the fans seem to be very, very delighted that there might be a resolution with this situation, that McCourt's ownership might be coming to an end.
Unhappily for those fans eager for an opportunity to concentrate on baseball rather than divorce, loans, and diverted funds, the resolution of which Dylan Hernandez is speaking may be sometime in the realization. Frank McCourt may not go gently. At the end of the week, he was apparently exploring the possibility of suing Major League Baseball. Home was bitter for the New York Knicks last night. Having played the Celtics tough twice in Boston, the Knicks lost Game 3 of their first-round playoff series, 113-96. Boston leads that series 3-0. In other NBA postseason action, Atlanta upset Orlando 88-84 to take a 2-1 lead in their series, and the Lakers reasserted themselves against New Orleans 100-86. Los Angeles is also up 2-1. The Buffalo Sabres and the Nashville Predators both required overtimes to win their first-round NHL playoff games last night. Buffalo knocked off the Flyers 4-3, and Nashville slipped by Anaheim by the same score. The Predators, who have never before feasted on an opponent in a playoff series, can advance by beating Anaheim again on Sunday. Here to provide us with a more secure handle on North America's slipperiest game is the LA Times' Aline Elliott. Welcome back, Aline.
Thanks. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Buffalo is the East's seventh-seeded team, and yet they are one win away from advancing to the conference semis. The Flyers were highly favored going in. Is goalie Ryan Miller playing well enough to get the Sabres past the Flyers and perhaps deep into the postseason?
Yes, and I think it's a great thing to see. They've awakened a great passion in the fans. The team has responded so positively. And the other thing I love is that they're all wearing sideburns and their hair in honor of Rick Martin. I think it looks great. They all look like they need shaves desperately, but I think it works.
Pittsburgh holds a 3-1 lead over their first-round opponent, the Tampa Bay Lightning. Game 5 is today. I guess they don't need Sidney Crosby after all, right?
Sidney who? Well, they need Sidney Crosby, but I think that their coach, Dan Bylsma, deserves an enormous amount of credit through the way he's gotten that team through. They retooled. They became a lot more attentive to defense. They play a tighter team game. They had to deal with that Chris Kunitz, who was suspended. They've had a lot of different injuries to deal with, and they've come through it in just remarkable fashion.
The Bruins dropped games 1-2 at home against the Canadiens, and the Habs returned the favor by allowing Boston to take games 3 and 4 up in Montreal. Which of these rivals wins what is now essentially a best 2 out of 3 series?
Didn't you mean your Bruins?
I try to be neutral as much as I can here, but yeah, you caught me.
I've been really entertained by that series. It's just been so incredible, the opposites and the extremes that they've gone to, and just the passion and emotion in that series. It's great stuff.
Well, especially given the enthusiasm of the home crowds in each city. Amazing that nobody's won a home game yet.
That's very true. I think we've seen that in the playoffs all through. There was one night last week where all 4 road teams won. And as we've seen, too, no lead is safe. And just ask any L.A. Kings fan about that.
Vancouver went up 3-0 over Chicago, but they have dropped the last 2 games. Have the Canucks gotten a case of the hockey yips, or have the Blackhawks found their 2010 championship form?
Boy, is everybody in Vancouver very nervous. I think the entire continent was sagging in that direction. It was just amazing. And think of it, the 2 Canadian teams that made the playoffs, Montreal and Vancouver, both struggling. It was just an incredible spectacle to see Vancouver take that 3-0 lead and then just completely collapse the next couple of games. That's making a lot of people very nervous up there.
You have been covering the San Jose-LA series, which currently stands at 3-1, favor of the Sharks. I thought this was the time of year when San Jose always folds in the playoffs.
No. You're off by a couple weeks. Wait until the second round, then they'll usually do it. I mean, you know, the Kings were going to have a tough time if they had gone in at full strength. If Andre Kopitar, their leading scorer all season, had been healthy, they might have had a chance to win this. But Kopitar has a broken ankle, and a lot of their flaws have really been obvious in this series. They just have no speed. Their defensive coverage is prone to just completely panicking and collapsing. They need to grow up a little bit, and they need a sniper, a scorer, a game breaker, and they don't have that.
Have you ever seen a wackier comeback, or maybe I should say collapse, than what took place in Game 3 of that Kings-Sharks series?
Yeah, everybody was trying to figure out what to call it, the stinker at Staples, or you know, the street that runs outside the arena is called Figueroa. So was it the flop on Figueroa, the fade on Figueroa, things that you can't say on impolite company
on
Figueroa?
Yeah, I could see that coming.
it was just one of the most stunning things I've seen. You know, they were up 4-0 55 seconds into the second period, and then they lose 6-5 in overtime. Just nobody could quite believe it. It was like they were drowning, and they just couldn't stop it.
This is once again a home team, the Kings in this case, that couldn't take advantage of playing at home.
Exactly. And you know, the Sharks pulled a bad time to forget that they're the Sharks.
Detroit swept Phoenix out of the playoffs. Now the Coyotes may be swept out of Phoenix. Arizona fans would seem to deserve better than this, don't you think?
I agree. I mean, just the way the ownership has evolved, and they've done everything wrong that they possibly could, and it's too bad. I mean, and I also thought the Coyotes would give Detroit a little bit more of a fight. I picked Detroit to win the series, but I thought maybe it would go six games. But Phoenix's goaltending was terrible, and they just don't have the depth, and you have to think a lot of the off-ice stuff was adversely affecting them.
What are the second-round matchups that you would most like to see?
I think it's going to be interesting whoever Detroit plays, because now Detroit gets a lot of rest, which can be good because they had some injuries, but it can also make them rusty. So I'm just curious to see how they're going to respond to that. Whoever comes out of the Vancouver-Chicago series is going to be very tired, going to be exhausted emotionally and physically. If it's Vancouver, they're going to go through the scare. And if it's Chicago, they're going to have to come back from 3-0, and they're going to be very tired and very spent. So whoever they play in the second round is going to be an interesting matchup, too.
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the LA Times, and she is our Zena of the Zamboni here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Johannes Schneider has long been a fan of the basketball team at his alma mater, Winthrop University. When he was a student there, he attended games clad only in a Winthrop University flag. His allegiance was obvious on Sunday when Mr. Schneider, 29, was married in Rock Hill, South Carolina. The bride, Michelle Waters, wore white, and as tradition dictates, she was given away by her father. The groom, the aforementioned Mr. Schneider, was given away by Big Stuff, the large and colorful bird who serves as the Winthrop basketball team's mascot. Said the father of the bride, "Well, there's something you don't see every day, a big bird at a wedding."
I want you children to fall right in, 'cause this year wedding is about to begin.
Now I'm the groom, don't start no stuff, I've been waiting here long enough.
Then get out the ring, it's plain to see.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the world's richest athletes by sport and by country. But first, knuckleball pitcher Tim Wakefield was drafted in 1988 by the Pittsburgh Pirates, who thought he might become a major league first baseman. A couple of seasons in the minors taught them otherwise, but in 1992, Wakefield made his debut on the Pittsburgh mound and went 8-1, and then he won two games in the World Series. For the past 16-plus seasons, the knuckleballer, whose autobiography titled Knuckler and written with Tony Maserati was published recently, has been pitching for the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park. That's where I caught up with him after a recent rainout. I began our conversation by asking Tim Wakefield about a particular passage in Knuckler, the part where he says, "The knuckleball is me."
It's what got me here. It's what I've lived and died with. It's, you know, I ate it, I drank it, I slept with it. It is me.
He also writes, at an early age, Tim Wakefield learned the knuckleball could be a weapon, something used to fluster people, even to make them quit. And it's an interesting proposition. Is the knuckleball really more likely to make people quit than, say, a hellacious, you know, curveball or a fastball that comes in at 99 miles an hour?
Yeah, I think it frustrates guys more than somebody throwing 100 or throwing a really nasty curveball. I think what we meant by that quote was, you know, I used it as a weapon at a young age because I used to throw it to teammates or friends, and they could never catch it. And
this is just playing catch.
This is just playing catch. And that's actually how I got recognized, is just playing catch. And, you know, it became my weapon. It became my source of survival, so to speak, that, you know, I was on my way out. I was going to be released, and my coach, Woody Heike, saw it in me, and it became what I needed to survive. I was a little reluctant to give up hitting after a little over a year trying to hit, and it wasn't my choice. They said either convert to a pitcher or you're going to get released. So I quickly changed my mind and my attitude at that point and started pitching and fell in love with it. You know, I had pitched in high school and never in college. I always wanted to be that big, strong, power-hitting first baseman that hits lots of home runs and all that stuff, but it quickly changed my mind.
Do you ever find yourself sitting in the bullpen or the dugout thinking, man, I'd like to just at least go out and take some batting practice?
Batting practice would be fun, but I do not miss hitting at all.
Plus, you might face a knuckleball.
I have actually faced a knuckleballer. Tom Candiotti and I faced each other when I was with the Pirates in 1992, and it wasn't very fun trying to hit off him either.
You have been the beneficiary of numbers of tutoring sessions with the Negroes, or at least one of the Negroes, and I guess it's Phil Negro who said knuckleball pitchers really have to be their own coach because pitching coaches don't really know what to do. You're shaking your head. Does that make you at all lonely in the bullpen? You can't go to the pitching coach for help, at least with the pitch you throw.
At times, it can get lonely, but for the most part, you want to rely on a pitching coach. And I've told all my pitching coach my checkpoints, my mechanics. If you see something that's out of whack, please let me know. But for the most part, I've been left alone, and, you know, through trials and tribulations, I've figured out what works best.
Do you use film at all?
I have used film. I don't like to look at it too much because you start digging too deep and you might find something that you don't want to find. So I base everything on feel and timing.
What do you mean you don't want to find, like, your beard is coming in a little gray or something?
That might work, or, you know, I need a haircut or something like that. But, you know, you start tinkering too much with mechanics, and then your thought process when you're out there competing turns to your mechanics instead of what you're trying to do, is that's to make a good pitch and a quality pitch and get it out.
Just has to happen.
Just has to happen. You got to get out of your own way sometimes.
It strikes me that there's an illusion with a knuckleball pitcher. If you're in the stands watching a knuckleball pitcher throw and you're thinking, man, that thing is coming up there so slowly. I've been a fast-pitch softball player. I could hit that thing.
Yeah.
And yet we watch major league hitters struggle eternally with it. It's a curious sort of phenomenon. It is.
And I think it helps with the fans relate to me more because they'll sit in the stands and watch me throw and look at the radar gun and it says 65. And they say the same thing you just said. It's like, wow, I could probably do that. An old knuckleballer said you had to have the mind of a Zen Buddhist and the fingertips of a safecracker to throw a knuckleball. And the mind part is very true because when you're facing the best hitters in the world, you have to rely on movement, and you have to have the courage to throw a pitch up there at 65 miles an hour, and hopefully they swing and miss.
In the biography, you are characterized, and I'm quoting now, as willing as ever to fill a team need. But as this season has begun, and you've come into games with the Red Sox already behind 5 runs, behind 6 runs, whatever it might be, that can't be as much fun as it would be to start a game or come in with a game on the line?
No, and I consider myself a starting pitcher that's because of the knuckleball and because of my versatility, I think it's maybe take it for granted a little bit at times. And I think any other knuckleball will tell you the same thing. Me as a starting, my biggest value as a starting pitcher is to give the club innings. And I think I've proven that over the past 17 years here, that when I'm in the starting rotation every 5 days, I'm going to give you 180 to 200 innings every single year. Unfortunately, with the situation here, we have five quality starters, and you know, I'm the odd guy out, but I'm willing to do whatever it takes to try to help us win. If mop-up innings are it, then that's what I have to deal with. I mean, it's my job, and you know, I'm part of this team, and I'm trying to help us win another World Series.
It was interesting for me to read that you considered it one of the highlights of your career when you got a particular message on a particular day from Joe Torre. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was pretty special. You know, I'd always had respect for Joe, not only as a player, you know, growing up watching him play for the Atlanta Braves for such a long period of time, but also playing against him as the manager for the New York Yankees. And you respected how he ran his team and never really got a chance to talk to him, just to say hello to him on the field. And after the 03 season, you know, I gave up the homer to Aaron Boone to lose and pushed them into the World Series. The following year, we could make the greatest comeback in sports history, being down 3-0. And during our celebration, the phone actually rang in the clubhouse. When I picked it up, it was Joe Torre. And he actually wanted to congratulate me personally that, you know, he's very proud of my body of work and that he's witnessed over the long time that he was a manager for the Yankees, and he wanted to wish me luck and tell me to have fun.
And this was a guy whose team had just gotten knocked out of it.
Yeah, that says a lot about Joe Torre. It shows a lot about his professionalism and the respect that he has for the game.
Tim, successful knuckleball pitchers can have very long careers. No question about that. The list is long of guys who've managed that. And I'm sure that you're very proud of the career that you are having. But I wonder what it's like to see everybody else in the clubhouse getting younger and younger each year.
There is a huge generation gap there, that's for sure. But, you know, I try to lead by example and not by my words. And if I can set a good example for a younger player, I'm more than happy to do that. And if they ever want to pick my brain, I'm always available in my locker for them to come talk about. You know, I can share some past experiences with them. You know, I've been through the ups and downs and the twists and the turns, and know what it's like to struggle and know what it's like to succeed, and how to maintain that steady walk through a career.
I want to thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Tim Wakefield's book, Knuckler, My Life with Baseball's Most Confounding Pitch, written with Tony Maserati, is published by Houghton Mifflin. You can hear a longer edition of our conversation by visiting onlyagame.org and clicking on podcast. Everybody knows that the most successful baseball and basketball players make a lot of money. But how many people know that international athletes can make a killing in darts, badminton, cricket, and rugby? The current issue of ESPN the magazine, titled All About the Money, features articles, charts, lists, and anecdotes providing a global perspective on sports and money. Joining me now is the editor-in-chief of ESPN the magazine, Gary Belsky. Gary, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me. It is only a game, but it's often a very well-compensated game.
Boy, the magazine certainly demonstrates that. One of your tables lists the most highly compensated athlete in each of 181 countries. Were you and your colleagues surprised to find that in 113 of those 181 countries, the athlete was a soccer player?
Yes and no. Yes, when we tabulated the numbers and realized that the highest paid athlete in 180-odd countries, 60% of them or so were soccer players, we were surprised. No, because as soon as we saw the number and realized that, of course, soccer is the big global sport, and that's where a lot of the money is, and that's where a lot of the talent from many countries goes to make their money, we felt like we should have predicted it. But there's a lot of other sports represented, too, obviously. There's out of 180 countries, there were 113 soccer teams, but also 17 basketball players, 12 baseball athletes, you know, six racers, and so on. There was even a yachter From New Zealand, by the way, I think.
The table also lists the average per capita income in each of the 181 nations. NBA player Samuel Dellembert, who earns over $12 million a year playing in the NBA, is a native of Haiti, where the average per capita income is $626. And that's not the only example of an extraordinarily wide income gap, is it?
No, exactly. Stéphane Cessignon, who plays soccer for Sunderland in the EPL, he makes about $2.8 million, and this is just an annual salary. It's not in endorsements. He makes about $2.8 million a year, and the per capita GDP in Benin, where he's from, is $739.
What led you to include the per capita income column in the chart?
Because we thought very smart and handsome radio show hosts would notice that and talk about it. Honestly, that's why we did it. We thought that, you know, when people are interested in sports and money and in athletes and money, they're often interested in it because of a relative notion of wealth, right? People often talk about what athletes and entertainers make and then sort of start talking about what teachers make or what sanitation workers make. And we obviously wanted to sort of highlight that idea. By the way, we're of the belief here that there's nothing new under the sun. In the introduction to the whole package, we made the observation that arguably the richest, most successful athlete in the world monetarily in history was a chariot racer from 2,000 years ago who's got a monument to him in Italy now. And in it, on the monument, it indicates that he made enough money in his career to feed the Roman army, an entire Roman army for 1 year. Basically, he made the equivalent of $15 billion over the course of his career. So people have been paying athletes a lot of money, excess amounts, for a long time because the skills are rare and what they do is fun to watch.
If tennis great Kim Clijsters had made $5.5 million last year instead of just over $5 million, she would have been the most highly paid athlete in Belgium, but she wasn't.
And the only woman to make the list.
That's what I was going to say. Did any other woman even come close to being the highest paid athlete in her country?
I think the answer is sort of no. Certainly in the United States, there's a lot of sort of well-paid women, but nobody that comes close to, Venus Williams, people like that, but nobody that comes close to what A-Rod makes. So the answer is I couldn't go down to all 180 countries and tell you whether or not there was somebody in Mauritania who made as much as the soccer player Pascal Gourville. But for the most part, women's compensation is still far below that of men.
Mm-hmm. You also included a list of the best-paid athletes in 30 sports.
That was my favorite list.
It's a great list. Who knew that it was possible for somebody to make over $1 million a year playing darts or riding bulls or over $200,000 a year in competitive eating?
Exactly. You can also make close to $500,000 a year being a sumo wrestler. And you can make $500,000 a year riding rodeo and $300,000 a year playing racquetball. There's a lot of ways to make money in sports that's just not about playing the big six or big ten sports. I mean, we did this list obviously because we wanted to go pretty deep into what people think of as professional athletes. You know, by the way, it's interesting. What got us actually to think about this whole entire list thing in the issue was something from the census, the U.S. Census, that said that there's, I forgot the number, but essentially the average pay for a professional athlete in the United States is like $70,000 or $60,000. That's because there are tens of thousands of professional athletes in the United States, you know, a greater number than you would think when you just think about, you know, baseball, football, hockey, basketball, minor league baseball, a couple of other sports. You know, you sort of think like, oh, there's probably like, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 people who are making their living playing professional sports. There's quite a bit more than that, actually.
I'm speaking with Gary Belsky, the editor-in-chief of ESPN, the magazine, and you're listening to Only a Game. The most successful athletes do make a lot of money, of course, but All About the Money also demonstrates that there are a lot of very expensive things on which athletes can spend and lots of scams of which they need to be very wary. What are some of those?
The things they spend money on are pretty much anything and everything. It's about exclusivity, right? We talk about, it's expensive for me to fly somewhere, but it's more expensive for athletes because they want to fly in absolute comfort and in privacy, so they will get a NetJets membership, which allows them to sort of participate in the whole world of private jet flying, and that can cost tens of thousands of dollars a year. But the much more interesting parts for us than the how much athletes spend on crazy things is how vulnerable athletes are to being ripped off by the people who are allegedly or presumably trying to help them. In general, there's stories all the time. We chronicle one in depth, but we also talk about the more notorious stories in which athletes who don't know very much about finances, mostly because they've been insulated from having to know very much about finances, not because they're not smart, but because somebody's always taking care of it for them, and they fall victim to shady operators, agents, business managers, things like that. I always like to tell people the story. This is a great issue. The single most amazing or the most profound financial-related story we've ever done in the history of the magazine, in my opinion, was a piece we did in the first year in 1998 about Ron Artest. Mm-hmm. And in it, we took Ron Artest, we put him on a playground in Kingsbridge in Queens where he grew up, and we surrounded him with all the people who he was supporting with his rookie salary. And there was about 40 people there, and Artest, who is he's a bit of a quirky personality, but he's a really honest guy. As a kid, as a rookie, he sort of went through everybody on that court in the picture and said, here's what I give them, $40,000 to my friend who's a barber, $25,000 for this guy who's my buddy who's a driver, my uncle gets $60,000 for being my cook, whatever the case may be, right? And the reason why that story was important to us here at ESPN the magazine was we realized something profound, which was that when athletes, at least a lot of athletes in a lot of sports, when they talk about wanting to go from $6 million a year to $10 million a year because they need to take care of their family, and a lot of people and a lot of sports writers roll their eyes and say, how much do you need to take care of your family? Well, you need a lot when your definition of family is so broad and generous. Everybody wants to go to the easy trope of, oh, athletes make too much money, or they're all greedy, when in fact, they're often some of the most generous people in the world because they're supporting dozens and dozens of people. And sometimes they get ripped off because they're too trusting.
Gary Belsky is the editor-in-chief of ESPN the magazine, the current issue of which is titled All About the Money. Gary, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
The Redfish Roundup in Florida is an unusual competition because the idea isn't to catch the largest fish, it's to catch the redfish with the largest number of red spots on its body. This is truly a competition in which size doesn't matter, unless it does. No redfish shorter than 18 inches can qualify for the $7,500 prize, no matter how many spots it sports. But a fish that measures just barely 18 inches if you pull on its tail is okay, and that's what Otis Chauncey hauled in last weekend. In fact, though Mr. Chauncey's fish was the smallest one examined by the judges, the little winner wore no fewer than 27 red spots. After the competition, the red-faced Mr. Chauncey was spotted giggling.
Looks like, honey, we're gonna roll in late because of too much beer and not enough bait.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Korfball. You wondered when we were going to get to that, right? Well, wonder no more. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Is the korf that which you hit the ball with?
I'm telling you, you're going to have to stay tuned, and you'll learn everything you want to know about korfball. The NBA playoffs are a week old. The Miami Heat owns a 3-0 lead over Philadelphia, and the Chicago Bulls will try to sweep Indiana today. Have you found round one to be a little lackluster?
No, I found round one to be the greatest ad for the NBA in the past 10 years. The quality of play has been very high. Both Philadelphia and the Pacers have really given wonderful accounts of themselves. The Knicks-Celtics series has been terrific. I think this was a very, very good week for the NBA.
Among the teams looking strong in the first round is the Oklahoma City Thunder, up 2-0 against the Denver Nuggets. Do you see Kevin Durant and company advancing deep into the postseason?
I see the possibility that Kevin Durant and the Thunder will make the NBA Finals. I mean, they are tremendously mature. The key change is that Russell Westbrook has become an elite NBA point guard, and that gives them two players who are extraordinarily hard to guard. They're young, they're enthusiastic, they play very hard, they're well-coached, and right now I don't see anybody. San Antonio is impressing no one. The Lakers are injured and impressing no one. I see no reason why Oklahoma City can't make the finals.
Gary Bettman, the commissioner of the National Hockey League, said this week, quote, "It's nice to go out and find out you're pretty." Was he talking about?
I hope he was talking about their new television package and not the fact that he, he's auditioning for some road company of West Side Story. $2 billion, and it runs through 2020 and 2021. They are going to be staying on NBC and versus the formerly Big Fish Network, where they seem to be happy and are very well wanted. There was some talk that ESPN would get back in the game, NHL having spurned them stupidly almost a decade ago now. But it looks like they're going to stay where they are.
Talks between the NFL owners and players' representatives have adjourned until May 16th, but there was a major development this week. The NFL 2011 schedule was released. Was that a preposterously optimistic thing to do?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but it gave NFL fans something to talk about besides labor strife, which I guess is a good thing.
You have the 2011 NFL grid in front of you as we speak. So, quick, what are the 10 must-see games of 2011? Assuming there are any games to see in 2011.
I think long about. Let's take a look, because this may be the way it works out. Let's look all around week 8 and see who's playing who.
Which will be week 1.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. The Los Angeles Dodgers are now wards of Commissioner Bud. L.A. fans seem to be pleased by this, but not everybody, I gather.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what this is all about. I mean, if Bud Selig wanted to take over a financially struggling baseball team, he didn't have to go all the way over across the country to do it. The Dodgers are merely tangled up in a messy divorce. The Mets are tangled up with Bernie Madoff. And somehow that's okay, but the Dodgers require Bud's special attention.
Should we send a message to baseball fans in Cleveland and in Colorado saying, enjoy it while you can? Or are the Indians and Rockies likely to continue to occupy first place in their respective divisions for a while?
I think the Rockies are going to compete for the entire year. I do not think the Indians are. But the question arises, when the Tigers and White Sox, and to say nothing of the Twins, going to get their acts together?
When the Boston Red Sox won the 2004 World Series, there were many who celebrated the fact that it had been 86 years between championships, but that may not have been exactly the case, I guess.
Well, no, they won. It's just the possibility exists that the Chicago Cubs may have thrown the 1918 World Series. This came out this week when somebody found a court deposition given in 1920 by Eddie Seacott, the Chicago White Sox pitcher who was pivotal to the fix of the 1919 World Series. In the deposition, Seacott said that while some of the boys on the club, quote-unquote, talked about a Cub or a number of Cubs being offered $10,000 to throw the 1918 World Series, which they lost 4-2 to the Boston Red Sox. The $10,000 figure, of course, is interesting because that's what Seacott got prior to Game 1 of the 1919 World Series, being one of the few members of the Black Sox who actually made any money on the deal. I think we all know that gambling was rife in baseball, that there were fixed games up and down the schedule until Kennesaw Mountain Landis put his foot down in 1919. I don't think this should surprise anyone.
Real Madrid beat Barcelona to win the Copa del Rey, or the King's Cup, an annual tournament involving the soccer teams in Spain, and the Madrid players made a nice job of their celebration, don't you think?
Yes, they put the trophy on top of the bus and then drove away, and the trophy fell off the bus, and the bus drove over the trophy. I think they should make the new one out of whatever stuff the Stanley Cup is made out of, because that seems to be able to survive better than this one did.
To their credit, the people at Real Madrid say that they will fix it.
You remember the old comedy routine about the only thing you find in a plane crash is the black box, so why don't you make the airplane out of the stuff they make the black box out of? Why don't you make the trophy out of what they make the Stanley Cup?
Yeah, good
idea. You
can
throw the Stanley Cup in a river and get away with it.
It was announced this week that the fight in July, matching Vladimir Klitschko with David Haye, will unify all the heavyweight titles. So-called unification bouts used to be a big deal, especially when it was heavyweights involved. Is that still the case?
Boxing used to be a big deal, and now it's not, and it's not the case. This is not to say that 9 new governing bodies may not sprout between now and July.
In this week's
Bob's Boxing Commission and Auto Body Repair may decide they have their own champion.
Screen Door Company. In this week's sports technology news, the Phillies brought in
a robot host
to throw out the first pitch on Wednesday. How'd that work out for him?
He got booed, actually, because he didn't throw the ball very well.
He didn't reach the plate.
I mean, but he did. But on the scale of robot pitchers and robotic politicians pitching, this wasn't altogether that bad.
No, it makes me wonder. We can put a man on the moon and we can't build a robot that can reach home.
And we can't build a trophy you can run a bus over.
And finally, Charlie, there had been high hopes for a new sport in Washington State, but apparently the dream has died. What was it?
Yeah, along with many of the participants, apparently. The Harmon Tap Room in Tacoma, Washington, used to buy some cheap goldfish at the local pet store and race them down 2 8-foot troughs. The racers would guide the fish with squirt bottles. Apparently, the local animal rights activists complained about this. The bartender told the television station that the fish were cared for when they were racing, but occasionally they would pass away. I would say often they would pass away, perhaps always they would pass away. But the wonderful thing is, of course, that the Harmon Tap Room has replaced goldfish racing with beer pong, thereby probably guaranteeing that human beings will go out and drive their cars sockless.
Charlie Pierce is the author of several books, including Idiot America, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Did him down at bottom chew, yeah, did him. Ooh, ooh, did him down at bottom chew. Ooh, ooh, did him down at bottom chew. And they swam back over the dam. All them little fishes were mullets. That's what they bought. They're everyone mullets. Baby mullets.
The sport of korfball enjoys a strong following in Holland, Belgium, and several other European countries. And 2 weeks ago, a small, dedicated group of U.S. players gathered in Clinton, New York for a rare opportunity to practice and play their sport. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
Korfball is spelled K-O-R-F-B-A-L-L. Korf means basket in Dutch. But as enthusiasts will tell you, the sport is very different from American basketball.
So it's really Dutch basketball. So I think of basketball, but with some European or soccer-type rules.
And you move the ball by passing, so it's a lot of cooperation.
Think of it as a cross between Ultimate Frisbee and basketball.
Guys can't guard girls, and girls can't guard guys.
So you're trying to get this ball into this hoop, the korf, taller than a basketball hoop, no backboard. So a little added challenge to it.
You know, why there's no backboard, who knows? That's just what they had.
I mean, you're not running into each other. You don't have to worry about getting hit.
But when you got the ball, you can't move. You can pivot.
It's 1 point per basket, regardless of where it's shot from.
Today, Hamilton College's korfball organization, HamilKorf, is hosting its second annual tournament. Junior Louis Bogaqual is the founder. Originally from Pound Ridge, New York, Bogaqual spent his first year of college in St. Andrews, Scotland, and tried korfball on a whim.
I'd never heard of it, and my goal on my year abroad was just do everything I can, get into something cultural I'd never heard of. This really fit the bill. So I joined, and it was a great group of people, and it was just this interesting sport that anyone can play.
When Bogaqual decided to transfer to Hamilton for his sophomore year, he wasn't ready to give up his new hobby.
And I thought, you know, but there's one thing I don't want to leave behind, and that'd be korfball. So I said, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get this going in the U.S. or get it going in Hamilton, at the very least give it a shot.
Bogaqual held an information session, and before long, HamilKorf was holding 2 practices a week. Today, the korfball pitch is set up on a well-worn basketball court in an old campus gym. The korfball hoops are 3.5 meters, or about 11.5 feet, high. Older hoops feature a wicker cylinder, like a large laundry basket with the bottom cut out. The cylinders on modern hoops are bright yellow plastic. Students are warming up, shooting traditional black and white korfballs, which look exactly like soccer balls, and newer versions, which are gold and blue.
We're going to look for the first group to score 10 goals.
The morning opens with an instructional session led by Steve Barker. Today, Barker lives in Los Angeles, but he learned the game in the 1970s as a teenager growing up in England. He went on to play for Great Britain's national team and is coached at just about every level. He demonstrates the way to follow through on a korfball shot, which is a sort of two-handed set shot.
Make sure that you're expressing the shot fully. Really extend the fingers into the shot. You're taking all that power from the body and expressing it in the hands.
There are 16 players on the korfball court at a time, four men and four women per team. Barker says the game's structure keeps everyone involved and prevents players from becoming offensive or defensive specialists.
The court is split into two halves. So four of the team, two men and two women, four at the other end. One will be defense, one will be attack. Now after two goals, they swap over.
Carl Yerger traveled to New York from North Carolina, where he's a math professor at Davidson College. Yerger learned the game in England while studying at Cambridge. He says because there's no dribbling and players cannot shoot when they're closely guarded, korfball hasn't followed basketball's evolutionary path.
Height is less of an advantage in korfball, and it's more about speed and quickness and strategy. And the fact that it's really hard for one single person to take over a game. I mean, you can't just give the ball to the LeBron of korfball or the Kobe of korfball because they can only take two steps with the ball. It's not like they can juke through their defenders, you know, turn around twice and then dunk it. Right? It just doesn't work in korfball.
Carla Walters is a retired kinesiology professor. She taught a korfball course that sparked a brief craze a few years ago at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. She says it caught on quickly with her students.
I have found that they love it being a co-ed game. They can play with their boyfriend or their girlfriend and play at the same time. You don't have to cheer from the sidelines. You can play together. And it's something that they really probably haven't done since elementary school is play a sport together.
Hamilton student James Kamihachi says he was never an athlete in high school, but he quickly got comfortable playing korfball.
I liked a lot of the people in korfball, made a lot of good friends here, but for me it was a game that was easy to pick up. It's a very passing, heavily oriented game, so everyone gets to play. So it was a sport that I actually could participate in, and I actually got to a point where I was reasonably good and felt confident. It was really the first team sport I've ever played.
Kamihachi's words would probably make korfball creator Nico Broekhuizen smile. Broekhuizen was a school teacher in Amsterdam in the early 1900s. After seeing an exhibition of a new sport called basketball in Sweden, Broekhuizen began developing a game all of his students, male and female, could play simultaneously. He unveiled korfball in Holland in 1903. Today, the International Korfball Federation has member organizations in more than 50 countries. Here in the U.S., the game's been played for decades. Rockport, Maine resident Rebecca Shields first played in the late 1970s at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
In the 70s and 80s, there was some momentum. We were trying to drum up support, and we were getting clubs, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Eugene, Oregon, and Houston, Texas, and the University of New Mexico. So there were some clubs in different parts of the United States. As those people started having families and people got busy, then that momentum was starting to kind of crunch.
That's why a small korfball event in a tiny upstate New York village has attracted players from all over the country. Korfballers have a tough time getting a game. U.S. Korfball Federation President David Warren, who makes korfball hoops and provided Hamilkorf with its first set of equipment, came all the way from West Virginia.
I drove up here, it was about 8 hours, and I came to play because it's the only game in town, I guess, because we don't have too many events going on, so if I wanted to play, this is where I had to come to play.
Warren also learned the game in the 70s at Oral Roberts University and has played for the U.S. at multiple world championships. He says it's frustrating to see the sport struggle here, having seen how it's flourished overseas.
If you go to a Dutch korfball club, you'll have korfball players that could be 5 years old or 65 years old. Some clubs might have 10 teams. But every level is represented, from the highest level to just recreation, you know, kind of like softball is here. You know, you have church teams and you have really recreation teams and you have real competitive teams, and that's the way it is over in Holland.
Ball's up here.
After the training session ends, scrimmaging begins. A true korfball court would be 40 meters by 20 meters, roughly a third larger than a basketball court. Play carries on in front and in back of the hoops, and without a backboard in the way, shots and misses can come from any and all angles around the freestanding post. Games last 60 minutes, and with baskets worth just 1 point apiece, they're not high-scoring affairs. Elite teams might score between 20 and 30 points in a game. Here at Hamilton, with a mix of rusty veterans and developing newcomers, most of the final scores end in the single digits. Can the new burst of enthusiasm at Hamilton launch a korfball comeback? Tournament organizer and USKF board member Louis Bogaqual is trying to get other colleges interested in korfball. He's not sure if it will spread, but he knows the kind of people the sport needs.
These people are definitely open-minded because they heard about this and they're at least willing to show up and give it a go. They're people who want some exercise, want to have some fun, but they don't want to, you know, be on a team for 6 days a week, giving a couple hours a day. They want to try something new. There's that niche. And also, I guess you might say, something kind of crazy zany about them.
If that sounds like you, korfball may be your sport. Nearly all of the players here say making new friends is one of the best parts of the game. It's a small, close-knit group, but they'd love to add a few more members. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To see Doug Tribou's photos of the korfball tournament at Hamilton College, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from U.S. Korfball Federation board member Carl Jurger, who points out just one of korfball's many attractions.
Normally it's just the guys or just the girls, but now you've got men and women in high-pressure situations, which sometimes can make for very interesting situations.
As Charlie Pierce would say, sports. Bill Littlefield, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.